From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
I want to thank you for the seeds you planted in me. I want to thank you for the earth that roots my feet. And I say, I want to thank you for the sun that greens my leaves. Yes.
Today, one of the leading progressive voices in music, hip-hop artist and activist Michael Franti, on the failures of the music community in a time of war, and his new song, Bomb the World. Yasser Arafat appeals to Palestinians to halt all armed activity in the occupied territories. The Indian government threatens to take action against fellow nuclear power Pakistan after last week's suicide attack on the Indian parliament. And the domestic crackdown on civil liberties continues. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. The surviving remnants of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda yesterday fled across frozen mountaintops in a bloody rout that left hundreds of them dead. Pro-Western Mujahideen commanders declared they had captured all the caves used by al-Qaeda fighters and had liberated Afghanistan of foreign terrorists. But despite weeks of rumors that he was hiding inside the Tora Bora caves, there was no sign of bin Laden yesterday. U.S. warplanes continued to stage overnight raids in Tora Bora and injured several U.S. allied Afghan fighters. Three Marines were wounded by a landmine yesterday at the airport outside Kandahar as they worked to clear an airport building of mines and U.S. cluster bombs. The men were quickly evacuated to the field hospital at Camp Rhino in southern Afghanistan. One of them, who lost his leg below the knee when he stepped on the mine, was evacuated to an Air Force hospital in the Persian Gulf area. Meanwhile, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld held talks at the Kabul Air Base with the new head of the Afghan interim government, Hamid Karzai, during the highest-level U.S. visit to the country in more than 20 years. Rumsfeld assured him that the U.S. had no territorial ambitions in sending its military to Afghanistan. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat last night made an impassioned televised appeal to Palestinians to halt armed attacks on Israeli civilians. Israel's tanks were parked only 200 yards from his Ramallah headquarters. Arafat denied buckling before the might of Israel's military offensive launched last Thursday, or to the mounting pressure for him to crack down on militants, saying terrorist attacks had violated the Palestinians' own national interest. Over the weekend, Israeli soldiers killed seven people in raids on more than four communities in the occupied territories. Israeli tanks and bulldozers carried out their biggest housing demolition of the Intifada at Khan Yunis and the Gaza Strip, knocking down 35 houses and making 345 people homeless. And residents of the West Bank town of Salfit testified to Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres that an Israeli undercover death squad shot two young policemen at close range as they lay unarmed on the ground. The first shipment of U.S. food sold to Cuba since the United States imposed a trade embargo 4 days ago has arrived. The shipment was part of a deal aimed at helping the country recover from the ravages of a powerful hurricane, which destroyed crops and caused millions of dollars in damage. The U.S. Congress last year approved the sale of food and agricultural products to Cuba, but such sales did not ensue as U.S. lawmakers staunchly opposed to Cuban President Fidel Castro nixed U.S. financing. The Washington Post reported yesterday that genetic fingerprinting studies indicate that the anthrax spores mailed to Capitol Hill are identical to stocks of the deadly bacteria maintained by the U.S. Army since 1980. This, according to scientists familiar with the most recent tests. Although many laboratories possess the Ames strain of anthrax involved in this fall's bioterrorist attacks, only five laboratories so far have been found to have spores with perfect genetic matches to those in the Senate letters. This, according to the scientists. And all those labs can trace back their samples to a single U.S. military source, the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, Maryland. One of the scientists said, this means the original source of the terrorist material had to have come from U.S. AMRID. That's, again, the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Disease. The FBI's investigation into the anthrax attacks is increasingly focusing on whether U.S. government bioweapons research programs, including one conducted by the CIA, may have been the source of deadly anthrax powder sent through the mail. The results of the genetic tests strengthen that possibility. In another weekend development, government health officials said they plan to recommend that about 3,000 people who were exposed to anthrax, including hundreds of Washington Postal and Capitol Hill workers, be offered an experimental vaccine as a precaution in case antibiotic treatment alone failed to protect them from getting sick. And President Bush has stirred a bipartisan firestorm Thursday when he invoked executive privilege to block a congressional subpoena exploring abuses in the Boston FBI office, including an investigation of campaign finance abuses. The order said releasing the records would be contrary to the national interests. Dan Burton, the Indiana Republican who heads the House Government Reform Committee, told a Justice Department official, "You tell the president there's going to be war between the president and this committee. We've got a dictatorial president and a Justice Department that does not want Congress involved." The searing tone continued for more than 4 hours from Republicans and Democrats. They said the order followed a pattern in which the Bush administration has limited access to presidential historical records, refused to give Congress documents about the vice president's energy task force, and unilaterally announced plans for military commissions that would try people accused of terrorism in secret. And you're listening to the War and Peace Report, as we're joined now live in our firehouse abode by Michael Franti.
Gonna keep on walking now, yes I will. Gonna keep on talking loud, yes I will. Gonna keep on singing about it, yes I will. Gonna keep on ringing now. I received a letter that you wrote me on a dark, cold and cloudy day, reminding me on the side of the road, you find a light, you'll find a friend, you'll find a way. But today I'm feeling all broke down, I ain't got the faintest clue about what to do. Well, can't comprehend the situation at hand, so I try my best just to get back home to you. Gonna keep on walking now, yes I will. Gonna keep on talking loud, yes I will. Gonna keep on singing about it, yes I will. Gonna keep on ringing now. Yoo-hoo-hoo, yoo-hoo-hoo, yoo-hoo-hoo.
Michael Franti, and we'll be talking with him in just a little while here on the War and Peace Report as we broadcast just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, and more than 3,300 people have been buried there. I'm Amy Goodman. Last night, Yasser Arafat made an impassioned plea to Palestinians to halt all armed activity in the occupied territories and especially attacks on Israeli civilians. Arafat was bowing to intense world pressure to rein in militants after a week of violence that killed 10 Israelis and 20 Palestinians and prompted the Israeli government to sever ties with the Palestinian Authority and launch wide-ranging military strikes in the occupied territories. With Israel's tanks parked only 200 yards from his Ramallah headquarters, the Palestinian leader also appealed to Israel to halt its military strikes, which have killed more than 60 Palestinians and wounded hundreds in recent weeks. Palestinian officials said yesterday they had already closed 33 offices of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, but that Israeli military attacks were making it more difficult to go after militants by destroying police and security buildings and generating intense public outrage. The Bush administration has publicly and explicitly defended Israeli military actions, which have involved the use of U.S.-supplied F-16 fighter jets and Apache helicopters. The United States vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution condemning terror attacks and calling for an end to the violence by both sides, with a U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Negroponte, saying the resolution was an attempt to isolate Israel. U.S. officials appearing on talk shows yesterday adopted virtually the same stance as the Ariel Sharon government, insisting the primary threat to peace in the Middle East is Palestinian terrorism, making no mention of the Israeli occupation. We go now to Israel and the occupied territories. We're joined by Amira Haas, who is a correspondent in the West Bank for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, one of Israel's leading journalists. She lives in Ramallah. And Isla Jad, professor of cultural studies and women's studies at Birzeit University. Isla Jad, let's begin with you. Can you describe the situation on the ground there now?
Is still very tense around. This morning we heard about the assassination of a Hamas militant in Hebron and also the killing of a security force member in the northern area in near Nablus. And this morning also three Israeli soldiers lost their way in Ramallah, and they have been captured by the Israeli, by the Palestinian security forces, and they have been handed to the Israeli side. So this event showed that unfortunately the Israelis are not willing, you know, to calm down the situation, to enable the Palestinians to resume negotiations with the Israeli side.
Isla Jad, what about the speech of Yasser Arafat yesterday? Can you talk about its significance?
I think it's very significant because the Israelis always wanted the Palestinian president to address, you know, the Israeli public and also the Palestinians to hold, you know, activities against the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza. The speech of yesterday was very clear in addressing especially the Israeli public in saying that the resistance of the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation forces in the West Bank and Gaza does not intend to threaten the existence of the State of Israel. And he denounced very clearly the attacks of suiciders inside the State of Israel, and he said that the Palestinians are aiming to establish their own independent Palestinian state on the territories occupied in 67 war between Arabs and Israelis, which it means that this independent state will be established side by side with the Israeli state. And this goes along you know, the whole propaganda of the, unfortunately, of the Israeli actual government, saying that the Palestinians are wishing to throw Jews in the sea again, and they are threatening the existence of the State of Israel. Even with this, you know, suicide attacks, I think it's basically out of desperation and out of the total brutality of the Israeli troops, you know, against the Palestinian civilians, and also of the settlers, you know, against the Palestinian civilians. So I think it addressed the Israeli public in securing them that the aim or the ultimate goal of the Palestinians is to establish a Palestinian state on the occupied territories in 67 war.
Isla Jad is with us. Yes, Isla Jad from, are you now in Ramallah?
Yes, I'm now in Ramallah, and as you might know, we are fully surrounded by Israeli troops from all sides. Since now almost 2 weeks, I'm not allowed to reach my university, the campus of my university. Our students cannot reach also the campus, especially students living in villages nearby the city of Ramallah. And if I can summarize my situation now, now I am allowed to circulate around my house of something like from 3 to 5 kilometers at the maximum. But the city is surrounded by Israeli troops from all parts, from the northern part towards Birzeit University, from the southern part towards Jerusalem. And by the way, me and many others, you know, in the city, we are not allowed to reach the city of Jerusalem. I'm talking here the Arab part of the city of Jerusalem, since more than now, you know, 9 years. And if we want to go to the Arab part of Jerusalem, we have to get a permit. And it's almost to get a permit from the Israeli troops, and it's close to impossible sometimes, you know, to get this permit. And also, we are not allowed to use the Tel Aviv airport or the Lod or airport. So I can just say that we live in a very medium-sized prison with most of the people hostage in, you know, this city, surrounded by Israeli troops from all parts and sides. And of course, the orchestra of the night, it's always some, you know, shelling here and there by Israeli tanks and helicopters and heavy weapons. I live far away, something like 20 meters from a Quakers school by the name of the Friends School. And the school was hit 3 days ago by Israeli rockets from a helicopter, because it's very close to the remaining of the Ramallah police station, which it was already destroyed a few months ago. So, you know, the whole house where I live was shaken by the force of the rockets, you know, hitting the school. And of course, the most of the kids around we, you know, were suffering from a terrible panic attack.
Islah Jad, we're also joined from Ramallah by Amira Haas, who is a reporter with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the first and only Israeli journalist to live in the Palestinian territories. Went first to live in Gaza Strip in 1991 and then moved to Ramallah, where she continues her difficult and dangerous work. Can you talk about the Israeli reaction, Amira Haas, to Yasser Arafat's speech yesterday?
Well, being here, it's a bit difficult to talk about the Israeli... I mean, being here in Ramallah is a bit difficult to talk about Israeli reaction. Only I could gather from a few talks this morning and from my editors is that they don't really believe the sincerity of Arafat, and they say that they are waiting for deeds, not words, and they expect him to have more arrests among Islamist activists, according to the list that Israel submitted to him, and to bring to a complete halt of all use of arms, not only in Israel proper, but also in the occupied territories.
As an Israeli Jewish journalist, what we just heard Islah Jad describe about just what it is to live in Ramallah, as she describes this prison, do Israelis understand this, let alone the international community where you aren't right now? But we don't get these descriptions in the United States from that vantage point.
Well, I try to give as much as I can and as much as the place in my paper proper allows me, but there is a big gap between knowledge and awareness, and awareness and difference and understanding. And I think that most of the Israelis are captive now in their own sense of victimology, and they have forgotten. But it's not a new thing. They have forgotten that we are talking about occupation. They have forgotten this, not this year, but they have forgotten this during the Oslo process, which did not bring Palestinians any prospect for independence and tranquility, but on the contrary, for the general majority of the Palestinians, it was just a negative process and a backward process in terms of personal and community welfare and independence. And most of the Israelis also in the peace camp refused to see this state of affairs. So, of course, they were very insulted when Palestinians broke out, when the Intifada of this year broke out, which shaked their more or less convenient life with occupation, but without bearing the responsibilities of occupation over the Palestinians.
Do you think... what's taking place right now, even before the rash of suicide bombings, Amira Haas, was all part of Ariel Sharon's design?
You mean since the beginning of the Intifada?
No, I mean since he has come to power in dealing with Yasser Arafat, as the Israeli parliament has severed relationship with him, etc. Yeah. Though they're saying it's in reaction to the suicide bombing. Ariel Sharon clearly had a very clear plan.
Yeah, I guess we think that Sharon, he was against Oslo from the start. He was against peace with Palestinians from the start. I believe he continues projects that he hasn't finished in, or he thinks he completes processes he hasn't finished in 82, against Palestinian, not just against Palestinian leadership and Palestinian national movement, but actually against any prospect of Palestinian independence in a decent chunk of territory which will allow this kind of independence. So in that sense, he's not surprising. It's only that indeed with the suicide bombings in Israel, I think the Palestinians have lost a lot. And these suicide bombings happened in a situation of political vacuum where you didn't feel one Palestinian leadership stating out very clearly the strategy of this intifada. And then it allowed all kind of other groupings to listen to people's anger with the unbearable and indescribable suffering, daily suffering and daily bereavement. And they went and did this suicide bombings with their own political agenda. I'm sure that the Islamists, especially Hamas, have their own political agenda within Palestinian society. So, and this indeed did a lot of harm. I, of course, oppose it on a moral basis, but it also inflicted a lot of harm to Palestinian struggle, because now it's even difficult to explain to people that Palestinians are fighting to hold occupation and for a state within the 67 borders. Fatah people who were from the start trying to make a distinction between Israel proper and occupied territories, also felt that now they cannot lead a fight within the occupied territories without being termed terrorists.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us and also giving us a glimpse of life in Ramallah. Amira Haas is an Israeli Jewish correspondent in Ramallah for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. She's also author of the book Drinking the Sea at Gaza. And Yisrach Jad with us from Ramallah as well, professor of cultural studies and women's studies at Brzeit University. As she has said over the last week, she has not even been able to get to her university. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we'll have a conversation with hip-hop artist and activist Michael Franti. We'll also find out about what it's like to be the nephew of a man who's just been picked up and threatened with deportation. Stay with us. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we go now to Rockefeller Center, where yesterday an alliance of New Yorkers from the New York Coalition for Peace and Justice gathered to lead a holiday rally for an end to war and to defend civil liberties here at home. Michael Franti sang, and a number of people spoke, including Susanna Dele, an Al-Ota activist, part of the committee to indict Ariel Sharon.
I'd like to begin by first saying something to those who are standing next to us on the other side. Those of you who came here to look at the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree, those of you who are celebrating Christmas, well, I just need you to stop for a moment and reflect and think about the fact that the very symbols of your holiday, the town of Bethlehem, the Church of Nativity, is right now being bombed to oblivion by U.S. bombs at a terrorist state known as Israel. And your silence and your deafness to the and you cannot ignore that. The U.S. media and the U.S. government would like to do everything they can to convince you that I am a supporter of terrorism, that you are supporters of terrorism, because we speak out against this racist war against the Afghan people, because we speak about freedom for people who've been under colonial European rule for over 50 years, the Palestinian people, because we say that you cannot round up my friends, my neighbors, my cousins, my uncles, my nephews. You cannot take them and throw them in jail and then not tell me where they are. You cannot do that. The men in our community are missing. We do not know where they are. During this holiday season, 2 days ago, we were prevented from sending money home to our family in Jordan. The U.S. government says that money is being sent for terrorist purposes. It's being sent to my sick grandmother who just suffered the loss of her husband. And I cannot send money home to my family because of U.S. racist policies. And I'm here to say to you that I'm sick and tired of this. I'm sick and tired of being called a terrorist. I'm sick and tired of this U.S.-Israeli war against the Palestinian people. I'm sick and tired of the terrorization of the Arab and Muslim community here. Two of my cousins have been victims of hate crimes. Okay, we have been stopped in the street, pointed at, and called terrorists. But I am not here to tell you that I need your help. I am not here to tell you that you need to pity us. This is not our fight. This is your fight. This is your fight. The civil liberties attacks are going to be redirected towards you, to all voices of political dissent in this country. And every time the United States helps Israel bomb the Palestinians, every time the United States bombs a place like Vieques, or bombs a place like Afghanistan, you, the American people, are fully responsible. It is your government who is doing this. This is your tax money. This is your fight, not ours.
Susanna Deli, she spoke yesterday at the protest against the war at New York's Rockefeller Center. She's with ALADA, the Right of Return Coalition. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. As we turn now to Abdullah Al-Aryan, he's a student at Duke University. He's also the nephew of Mazen Al-Najjar, who was detained and placed under federal deportation order since September 11th. Al-Najjar was released last December after being imprisoned for 3 years on secret evidence. But 3 weeks ago, INS officials greeted Al-Najjar as he left the house and have held him in detention ever since. They're threatening to deport him based on visa expiration charges. Abdullah Al-Aryan is also the son of American Muslim activist and professor Sami Al-Aryan, who teaches computer science at the University of South Florida. His Palestinian nationalist views have long been controversial in Tampa, where he lives and works. But after he appeared on the Fox News show, The O'Reilly Factor, where host Bill O'Reilly drew connections between him and terrorist groups, the university where he's worked was barraged by hundreds of threatening letters and emails and put Al-Aryan on leave. Abdullah Al-Aryan appeared on Democracy Now! Last July after he'd just begun an internship with Congressman David Bonier. He was approached by a White House security guard and asked to leave the premises with no reason given for his removal. Muslim leaders walked out of a White House meeting in protest at the exclusion of one of those attending. Al-Aryan wrote in a piece in the Duke University paper, The Chronicle, saying, "Unwarranted imprisonment show that civil liberties still need to be protected." We welcome you to Democracy Now! In Exile, Abdullah Al-Aryan.
Thank you.
Just a reminder to our listeners, the White House meeting you were taken out of by security guards?
Yes, it was the Secret Service at the time, and they provided me no reason, but I did receive an apology from the president the next day.
And tell us about your recent Thanksgiving.
Well, my Thanksgiving was A very special one indeed, simply for the fact that for the first time in 4 years, my uncle was home. And as you said, he was released from INS detention last December, and this was the first Thanksgiving and actually first the first Ramadan that he would be here for the whole time. And, you know, next thing I know, we wake up a Saturday morning on November 24th only to hear that he's been taken yet again.
Can you talk about what this means to your family and what the government is saying about him?
Well, I mean, it's extremely disheartening because we've been through this process already once before. We've been through the process of having to denounce allegations against you that you don't know what the allegations are or who they're coming from. We've simply heard this cloud of terrorist threats and you know, national security threats, and yet there's no evidence that's ever been shown to provide or to support those kind of allegations. Even a federal judge has said, after looking at both the public evidence and the secret evidence, that this person in no way poses a threat to national security or in no way can be linked to any sort of terrorism. But yet, you know, even though during the first experience, the judicial system was basically abused in order to have someone detained on 3.5 years based on secret evidence. In this instance, the judicial system seems to have been completely bypassed because a federal judge's decision was completely disregarded in the INS's decision to simply arrest him once again.
Finally, Abdullah Al-Aryan, what about you? You're a student at Duke University. We're hearing about college campuses around the country that are handing over the names of young Middle Eastern students to the FBI, giving over records. What's been your situation?
Well, my situation personally has not suffered as much, I think, as a lot of other campuses and a lot of other students. I mean, my experience has simply been, you know, trying to watch for the discrimination, the sort of profiling that occurs on a lot of different school campuses. And for the most part, I think it's been relatively fair. I mean, with everything that's happening, some of it, you know, has been warranted in order to have scrutiny, but at the same time, I think we have to be really careful not to abuse people's rights, especially students who are simply here to get an education. I mean, this is something that I think everyone has a right to, and it's a big mistake when we start cracking down on the students.
Has the FBI approached you to ask you the series of questions we now have been reading about, like who are your friends, what are their numbers, what were your feelings about September 11th that are being asked of supposedly 5,000 young men?
Not as of yet, no.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Abdullah Al-Aryan, senior at Duke University and nephew of Mazen al-Najjar, detained and placed under federal deportation order since the September 11th attacks. He was actually arrested after Thanksgiving. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Before we go to Michael Franti, we're going to go for a minute to New Delhi, India, where police have claimed to have established a link between Pakistan's intelligence service and last week's attack on Parliament in New Delhi that claimed 12 lives. 5 men armed with AK-47s and explosives stormed the complex on Thursday, killing 5 policemen, a security guard, a gardener, and themselves. India's foreign minister said India had issued a formal complaint to the Pakistani High Commission, claiming it had technical evidence that the attack was the work of one of 2 Kashmiri Islamic militant groups, either Lashkar-e-Taiba, the Army of the Pure, and Jaish-e-Mohammed, the Nation of Muhammad. India has given Pakistan an ultimatum to shut down the 2 groups, which some linked to the Al-Qaeda network. The Indian police said yesterday they'd arrested 3 people as part of their investigation. Sputnik Colombia is with us just for a minute to tell us the latest on the attack on Parliament and its significance. Welcome, Sputnik.
Hi, Amy. Good to be with you again.
Good to have you with us. Can you talk about the latest on this attack on Parliament?
Yes, well, the government in India is taking a very, very tough position, vowing to track down those responsible and go after the terrorists wherever they are. whoever they are. They have made no, they haven't hidden the fact that they would like to take a leaf out of the U.S. and out of the Israeli book and go after these terrorists. They claim to have conclusive, credible evidence that two Pakistani-based Kashmiri militant groups, the Jaish-e-Mohammed and the Lashkar-e-Toyba, were behind the December 13th attack on the Indian Parliament. Both groups have denied it, as well as the United Jihad Council, which is a Pakistani-based umbrella group representing Kashmiri separatist organizations, have also denied it. As you said in your introduction, India has lodged a very, very strong complaint with the Pakistani High Commission and has now called on Islamabad to arrest those officials, top officials of these two groups. Pakistan was very quick to condemn the attack, but in response to calls from some members of the BJP, the Hindu Revivalist Party, which heads the coalition, calling for hot pursuit and retaliation and attacks on what they call terror camps in Pakistan, Musharraf has given a very, very strict warning and a tough warning that India should not indulge in any adventurous tactics, as he put it. And the difference is, in terms of when India wants to compare its position with that of the Israelis or the United States, Pakistan is a nuclear country, unlike the Palestinians or the Afghans. So the situation is certainly very tense. There are also reports that there is a troop build-up on the Pakistani side. There has been fighting across the line of control in the last couple of days. The Indian government, it has to be said, is also trying to use the situation to push through a very, very unpopular and very, very controversial anti-terrorism ordinance. It was running into great trouble with the opposition to put it through. And as the opposition is pointing out, despite the ordinance which is already in place, it didn't prevent this terrorist attack from being carried out. It has also accused the government of not following up on warnings that such an attack was likely. The Home Minister and the Prime Minister had themselves both gone on record saying an attack on the parliament was likely, and this was over the whole of last month, that and yet this attack took place. So there is also an element of playing to the domestic audience, because the government faces a very tough election in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh in a couple of months and is expected to do badly in those polls. Plus, the government was in the receiving end of a terrible defense scandal where the government, which talks about nationalism and patriotism, is accused of having ordered coffins at extremely high prices for soldiers who died in the conflict with Pakistan 2 years ago in Kargil, and those coffins never arrived. So there's a big defense scam, and this terrorist attack now seems to have taken the heat off the government at a time when the opposition was calling on the government to step down.
Well, Sputnik,
you have now only terrorism.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. I'm going to ask you about the U.S. response to the attack on Parliament in our second hour. Sputnik Kalambi is a correspondent with Free Speech Radio News, speaking to us from New Delhi, India. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. For nearly a decade, hip-hop artist and activist Michael Franti has been one of the leading progressive voices in music. Rising out of the Bay Area music and political scene of the early 1990s, Michael Franti founded the Beatniks, Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopercy, and most recently, the musical collective Spearhead. Michael's music mixes hip-hop, soul, jazz influence, but is driven by his political lyrics. His latest album, Stay Human, proposes that grassroots community activists infiltrate, overthrow, and take the media into their own hands to get important political messages out to a wider audience. The album also takes on the death penalty, with songs interspersed by broadcasts from an imaginary pirate radio station. Stay Human Radio, working to prevent the execution of a community activist. He's also a longtime political activist, using his music to support anti-racist, anti-police brutality, and anti-war organizing around the country. In fact, on September 11th, Michael, the day of the attacks, you were about to have one of your big events dealing with police brutality.
For the last 3 years, we've put on a 911 festival in San Francisco. The first one was Mumia 911. It was to draw on September 11th to draw attention to the emergency state of Mumia's case. And the next year we expanded it to be about the prison industry in general. And we had bands and speakers speak about what's happening with the prison industry, and also including Mumia. And then this year we were scheduled to do it again. But this year, September 11th, obviously has taken on a new meaning. And so this year's concert became one for you know, highlighting the prison industry and the death penalty, but also drawing the connection between how we feel about revenge, which is really what the death penalty is about, and then linking that to this revenge that we feel that we need to exact on others as a result of this massacre that occurred in New York and at the Pentagon.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. If stations want to break into the music and say something, you can, but Michael's going to play a song for us.
Okay. Everybody wants to be who they want to be. Everybody wants to have a good time. I just want to hang out with my peaceful little family, playing sweet, sweet music with some friends of mine. But I try hard to fake it, but I can't do it all the time. Try hard to break it, but it was just a waste of my time. When I turn on my TV, seems they're winning all the time. I pray to God to please show me a sign. Has anybody seen my mind? Has anybody seen my mind? I would never ever leave you hanging on the corner. No, no, no. I would never ever leave you all alone. I always wanted you to know that you could depend on me. When I come to your place, I would never ever be without a home. But I try hard to fake it, but I can't do it all the time. Try hard to break it, but it was just a waste of my time. When I turn on my TV, seems they're winning all the time. I pray to God to please show me a sign. Has anybody seen my mind? Has anybody seen my mind? I want you to walk with me now, talk with me now, be with me now, and everything is alright. Walk with me now, talk with me now, be with me now, and everything is alright. Walk with me now, talk with me now, be with me now, and everything is alright. Walk with me now, talk with me now. But I try hard to fake it, I can't do it all the time. Try hard to break it, but it was just a waste of my time. When I turn on my TV, seems they're winning all the time. I pray to God to please show me a sign. Has anybody seen my mind? Has anybody seen my mind?
Michael Frani, live in our firehouse studio.
Nice.
Just blocks from Ground Zero. Can you talk about the music community or scene since September 11th? For example, you've been touring around with the group Blues Traveler.
Yeah. Well, I've been really disappointed with the music community. I feel like there haven't been really any artists, or a few artists, very small handful of people who have been speaking about peace. You know, I think everyone is so afraid of what the administration, the Bush administration, has laid out, that if you're not in support of the war, that in somehow you support terrorism. And I totally disagree with that. And I feel that the music community has always been one that is that has spoken out for peace and to question what was happening with world politics. And it seems like there's been this silence. And I think that it has to do with the globalization of the music industry and the fact that there's only sort of four or five major corporations that own all of the record labels now. And they're really interested in signing artists today who are not out there to, you know, bring great music to people, but are out there to bring quick dividends to the shareholders. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's affected the voice in music a lot.
What kind of pressure do you face, like just when you're on the road with a group that might not share your politics?
We've been out with a group that not specifically the members of the group, but some of the members of the crew that were working with us had made comments about a song I was singing that was a song in favor of peace, and you know, a lot of the people on the crew were in NYPD hats and were kind of distant from us, you know. But what we found is that as we traveled across the country, even in some places like Lincoln, Nebraska, where the audience was very kind of middle of the road, and some of the people were there were like country music fans and wearing cowboy hats, and this one sort of 50s-year-old gentleman came up to me after the show with a big belt buckle on, a big black cowboy hat, and I thought he was going to knock me out. And he came up to me and he said, you know, I seen Clint Black, I seen Garth Brooks, I seen these, but none of them ever sang a song about peace like you, and I just want to say thanks a lot. And so I was really heartened traveling across this country right now to see that what you hear on CNN about 85% of the people supporting this war is BS. And the people out there are most people just dealing with the 6 inches in front of their face, trying to raise their families, go about their life, had the wind knocked out of them by this attack, this massacre, and are now just being told what to think. And but if given the option for peace, they would much prefer that.
Michael Franny, can you sing the song that inspires the ire of some of the people you may travel with?
Yeah, this is a song that's about bombing, and we sang it also on the Craig Kilborn show a few weeks ago, and they taped it and then had us tape another song, and they didn't air this song.
Really? The other song. Craig Kilborn being the late night,
yeah, network.
TV show. They wouldn't air it.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Please tell me the reason you want us to unify. You say you're sorry, said there is no other choice. How can you feel sorry when you kill people with no voice? You can chase down all your enemies, bring them to their knees. You can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, you may even find a solution. Hunger and disease, you can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace. The earthquake of anger simply brings more of the same. Military madness, the smell of flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses, stand up if you're still sane. To all of us gone crazy, I sing this one refrain. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution.
destruction, to hunger and disease. Yes, we can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. And I sing power to the people, and I sing love to the people, y'all. I sing power to the people, and I sing love to the people, y'all. You may even find a solution to hunger and disease. You can bomb the world into pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace. We can chase down all our enemies. We can even bring them to their knees. Yes, we can bomb the world into pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.
Bomb the World, Michael Franti here in the Firehouse Studios of the War and Peace Report, Democracy Now in Exile. You talked about the music industry and how tough it is. Your last CD, an internet CD. Can you explain how you get your art out, your politics?
Well, we do it through the traditional route. You know, we work with an independent label, you know, and we get our records in stores as much as we can. We sell them on the road as much as we can. And through our website, we sort of more than use it as a vehicle for selling music, we just use it as a vehicle to galvanize the community of people who are into what we do. And the website is called spearheadvibrations.com. And but traveling on the road, you know, and playing music for people is the best way to deliver, you know. And my goal through my music is to try to relieve suffering, you know. And I want people to, if even for those moments while we're performing, to feel uplifted, to feel like you're not alone in the world, to feel like there's other people who are in this fight for justice and for peace.
You, since September 11th, have traveled through Europe, and in Europe now, there is not a lot of information here about the fact that European countries say they're not going to extradite terrorist suspects to the United States because of the military tribunals mm-hmm. and because of the death penalty. Mm-hmm. Your last CD, Stay Human, was all about the death penalty. Yeah. Can you talk about what you found in Europe when you were playing, what people's response was post 9/11?
Well, most people are first, you know, shocked and horrified by the attack, and then equally shocked and horrified by the attack that we've been engaging in over the last couple of months on the people of Afghanistan. And I think people in Europe have a closer connection to war because they've had so much war on their land, you know, and they realize that as soon as war begins, that we all lose. And they also have had more, quote unquote, terrorism, which is a word I don't like to use, but bombing in civilian, you know, times and times of peace. And so they also feel and understand the futility of bombing and recognize that all bombing is terrorism, no matter who does it. If it's the U.S. doing it and to another country, it's the same as somebody coming here and doing it to us. And so it was good to be there, and also to see that the media over there, although the you know, most of the corporate media there is pretty similar to what's happening here, you still see other stories within those newspapers of different opinions, and at least those opinions are having a chance to be aired there.
Unlike here.
Yeah.
How about one of your songs on the death penalty?
Okay. Listen, I'll do a cappella. Slam, bam, I come unseen, but like gasoline, you could tell I'm in the tank. Like money in the bank, I smell appealing, but I'm toxic, can send you reeling without an inkling. Keep it thinking, cause you gave cash to the feds if your school district for dead. Messed you up in the head, but still they saying nothing's wrong. Selling fire water by outlawing the bong. Still, but even the system is working, while half of my people are still out of working. Anonymous notes left in the pockets and coats of judges and juries from Frisco to Jersey. Threats and protests, politicians, mob debts, trumped up charges and phony arrests. Staged a lethal injection the night before the election, cause he got donation from the prison guards union. Singing, oh my God. And him, my mother got us living suicide. Singing, oh my God. And him, my mother got us living genocide. Listening to my stethoscope on a rope. Internal lullabies, human cries, thumps in silence, the language of violence, algorithmic, cataclysmic, seismic, biorhythmic, where you can make a life longer, but you can't save it. You can make a clone and then you try to enslave it, stealing DNA samples from the unborn. Then you coming after us because we sampled a James Brown horn. Scientists whose god is progress. A four-headed sheep is their latest project. The CIA running like they're Jones from Indiana, but they still won't talk about that Jones in Guyana. This ain't no cartoon. No one slips on bananas. Do you really think that that car killed Diana? Hell, I shot Ronald Reagan. I shot JFK. I slept with Marilyn and she sung me happy birthday. I'm singing, oh my God. And him, my mother got us living suicide. Singing, oh my God. And him, my mother got us living genocide. But politicians got lipstick on the collar. The whole media started to holler. But I don't give a damn who they screwing in private. I want to know who they screwing in public. Robbing, cheating, stealing, white-collar criminal, McDonald eating. You deserve a beating. Send you home weeping with a fat bill for your Caribbean weekend. For just about anything, they can bust us. False advertising saying halls of justice. You telling the youth don't be so violent, then you drop bombs in every single continent. Mandatory minimum sentencing, cause he got caught with a pocket full of medicine. Do that again, another 10 up in the fan. I feel so mad, I want a peaceful revolution. I'm singing, oh my God. I hear my mother got a living suicide, singing, oh my God. I hear my mother got a living genocide, but we keep moving on.
Michael Franti, oh my God. And that does it for the program. Michael, take us out to the next hour. If you'd like to get more information on his music, his work, go to spearheadvibrations.com. You can also go to our website if you'd like to let friends know about this program, democracynow.org. Oh, and Michael, here's to add to your wardrobe. Democracy nice. Now hat, the exception to the rulers, nice. And the vintage Democracy Now in Exile War and Peace Report.
Beautiful. Well, on behalf of everybody in the Bay Area where I live, we really appreciate all y'all. There's a whole staff up here you guys might not know, but this is really, truly... the front line here in terms of journalism.
So you think maybe the revolution will be televised?
Well, if it's on indie media, it will be.
Well, and a great shout out.
We'll have a miniseries after it's all over.
And a shout out to all the folks in San Francisco, Berkeley, KPFA. It was great to see you all with the whole Democracy Now! Staff this weekend. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner and Suganya Mahendra. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. You can hear us at WBIX.org, where Errol Maitland's at the helm. Special thanks to Downtown Community Television, where we're broadcasting from, broadcasting at channel 9415 on Dish Network, that's Free Speech TV, as well as cable access stations around the country and community radio stations. That's Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica. In exile from the embattled studios at WBAI, studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.